listening to Real Talk on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Dr. Sam and Mark Bailey, welcome to RCR. Firstly, before we get on to the topic that we talked a lot about last year, Sam, can I still call you doctors? Are you still officially Doctors Sam and Dr. Mark Bailey? Do you have those titles?
Yeah, well, this is something they actually really hate, Peter, is the fact that everyone refers to us as the Doctors Bailey. And as you know, it appears on the title of our publications, our books that we put out. And once you're a doctor, so once you've completed a university qualification, they can't take that one away from you. We are no longer licensed in the medical system, but neither Sam and I have any desire to be so. So you can still refer to us as doctors, but we're happy for you to call us Mark and Sam as well.
We're reformed doctors, Peter. That's what I like to say.
Reformed or recovering doctors.
Yeah.
Sam, let's go back to last year. We had the discussion about the Medical Council's Disciplinary Tribunal was having a hearing about you. I don't think they even told you that they were having the hearing. You certainly didn't appear in person. What was the outcome of all that?
Yeah, well, it's kind of a funny story, Peter, because I have to quickly say this is what we heard secondhand about the actual hearing itself, because what happened is that people turned up. I didn't go, obviously. And it was a real kangaroo court, like a proper show trial, where they played my videos instead of me speaking as evidence, and people gave them standing ovations. And it was there was several things that happened during the actual 5-day trial where at one point they were suggesting, well, they walked out, didn't they? They walked out of the audience were clapping. And
when you say they walked out, you mean the tribunal walked out?
The tribunal walked out for a period of time because of the ruckus, and then they came back in and were quietening everyone down. But at one point they said that they thought it would be a good idea for me to have a communications workshop. That was one of the suggestions. And one of the members of the trial said, I think she's quite good at communicating, actually. So we don't actually know, like, long story short, no one was there for the very last day, and nothing's been released on the website itself of what's happened. The only thing that I do definitely know is that I've been taken off the register, and we had a wee celebration on that when we found out, because we just, you know, saw it on the website. We know of people that have been sent bills, very expensive invoices, from the Medical Council. But so far today, I haven't had anything from them. I blocked their email address, so I don't receive anything from them that way. So I'm not, and nothing's been released. So it's sort of, I just know I've been taken off the register, and it's such a freedom.
Yeah, and I guess, Peter, to be clear to the audience listening, the last time Sam had any dealings with the Medical Council was more than 2 years ago. So we realised at that stage it was a complete farce, the whole process. I left the medical system in 2016, and the Medical Council still a couple of years ago decided to launch an investigation into me, even though I'd been out of the system for 5 years at that point. And we realised that the whole process was absolutely farcical. And what's happened is that the Medical Council they're trying to create a public perception that they are in control of the situation here. Now, it's spun out of control for them. There's dozens and dozens of doctors that they're trying to deal with. Only some of them they're talking about publicly. So there's a lot of cases like mine, Mark Edmund, Manny Garcia, Anne O'Reilly, Lee Willoughby, etc., that they don't want to talk about in public. So they're trying to make it look like there's a tiny number of doctors that they're successfully dealing with, when in fact, that's not the case at all. So for us, when the Medical Council first contacted Sam in 2020, we'd already been publishing for 6 months at this stage. And to us, when Sam first said, oh, the Medical Council's in touch with me, and I said, what for? They're irrelevant to what we do. We've got this international situation going on. We were speaking to reaching millions of people around the world, and then we had the little old New Zealand Medical Council telling Sam, you've got to stop right away. And they invited her to sign a legal document essentially saying that she'd never talk about COVID in public.
It was a gag order.
A gag order. And this is in like September 2020. And I mean, we're just getting started.
I'm intrigued, Sam, when you said the medical council have sent invoices for large amounts of money. Who have they sent those invoices to?
I don't know that we can divulge who that is, Peter, because there's stuff going on in the background. We know that the only one that published on the HPDT website is Peter Canaday's case, and it looks like the costs have been massively reduced because I think initially they were trying to invoice him for some six-figure amount, and it looks like on the website it's been reduced to $25,000, so they've cut more than $100,000 off this. But I mean, it's unprecedented, and I think what's happened is because previously the medical council would use people's reputations, so they would say, you know, we'll go public, we'll name this doctor. Well, that's no problem for us, and most of the doctors say NZDSOS because we're happy for our names to be out there. And in fact, if the medical council want to promote us, go ahead and do it. Thank you. And so that doesn't worry us. And the other thing they try and get people on is the ability to practice within the system with a medical license. But I mean, so many doctors now in New Zealand are giving up on that and saying it's not worth it, you know. And I know, Peter, you've talked to a few of these doctors too, who are saying, look, it's just if this is the requirement, if we're expected to lie to the public, to not give them informed consent, to involve them in experiments, etc., without them knowing, then if that's what it takes to have a medical license, many doctors are saying, okay, well, I'm out. I don't want to be part of that.
So how much do you think the medical council's attitude at the moment is contributing to what is obviously, in many parts of the country, a real shortage in primary care, a real shortage of general practitioners?
Well, of course, it's definitely negative. And I mean, they're trying to, this is not just in New Zealand, this is a worldwide strategy that they're doing. So there are other doctors, say, for example, there's a doctor in the UK called Dr. Sam White, who's undergone exactly the same experience that I've had. And he's had about a three-week trial that they're doing currently, I think. And this is this intimidation tactics. They don't want anyone dissenting from the government in the medical system, anybody. Like, it's, you are out once you start speaking and saying anything different from what the government says.
And I think it's important for people to know the history of organisations like the medical council. So when they initially formed, they were by doctors, for doctors, elected by their members. And the idea was that they would maintain high standards of medical practice amongst the profession. That's no longer the case. So the government took over the role of running the medical council essentially some time ago. Ostensibly, they're independent. But if you look at the 12 members of the council, I believe we have 8 that are appointed by the government. So for anyone to think that this is not controlled by the government, they're mistaken. And also knowing, Peter, some of the personal backgrounds to these people within the medical council, I mean, they don't put in competent people here. They put in people who are establishment figures who will do exactly what they're told, who will go along with policy. These are not critical thinkers who can examine what's going on and say, hang on, this doesn't make sense. They're essentially there to act as an enforcement wing for the government. And on the wider stage, the FSMB, the Federal State Medical Boards, you know, Joan Simeon in the Medical Council is linked to the FSMB.
She's the chief executive, isn't she?
Yeah, and this is like an international organisation for the discipline of doctors who dissent, basically. And the SFMB, it's a very shady organisation. We've got doctors like Bruce Dooley who have exposed them and shown they're connected to international corporations and the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, I know Bruce Dooley. He's the American or Canadian, isn't he? Based in Golden Bay near Takaka. Yes, I've met him. So how, shall we say, science-based, or how much of a science thread does the Medical Council of New Zealand undertake?
Well, it's not. It's political. They're essentially a political organisation that do whatever.
Do they have any research at all? Do they try and find out if what you guys are saying, and we'll come to that shortly, do they try and find out if what you guys are saying might be correct, might have some absolute credibility to it?
No, I mean, this was evident in those courts, or those, you know, kangaroo courts, was that they don't. Like, Peter Canaday really was the best example of that, where he actually went and responded and went through all their, and it was a joke from Peter's side. He won by a landslide, if you were to look at just what he provided as evidence. But it didn't matter, because they just say, we're not admitting this. This is not acceptable to us, or along those lines.
And also, Peter, they have their own so-called government experts, and you'll be aware of many of these figures who apparently whatever they say is true, and if you question that, it's not true. And so that's the expert witnesses they call on, these figures like Helen Patousis-Harris and Mark Thomas, etc., who are completely out of their depth in terms of the material that's being discussed. They don't even seem to be aware of the conversations, in fact, but they're the experts that they wheel in because they will back exactly what the government said.
Right, well, you guys are now living, I presume, very happily in North Canterbury, in the country, leading the lovely family life. What is the work that you do? How do you guys survive? Because people have still got to eat. People have still got to be able to afford to live. What is the work that you do to support your family now?
Yeah, so after kind of exiting the medical system, we've really focused on providing information to the public about health and writing books. And so I have a membership platform website. We're most of, to be honest, 90% of the content that we create, we do for free. And it's to try and teach people how to be well, essentially, and also unpacking a lot of so-called infectious diseases, because we can see that what's coming for us, this isn't the end like COVID-19, that was just the beginning, and this is going to keep repeating. And so it's to understand, if you still have a fear of contagion, a fear of germs, that's how they lock you in, and that's how they get you on all sorts of things like taking vaccines or within the health system. And so that's been our primary focus, is to reduce people's fear. And yeah, we homeschool our kids. We've changed our lives so massively living off the land that, to be honest, nothing, it's, if anything, our lives are so much better. And I mean, we're believers, we're Christians, and I felt like God has helped us this entire time. He's never let us down.
Yeah, and we certainly address wider issues as well within the medical industry. So coming from our position, Sam and I were both in the medical system for 2 decades. During that time, we worked in a lot of different specialties, including in the clinical trials industry, so supervising the development of new pharmaceuticals. So we have this unique position where we were fully trained in that system, worked in that system, and now I guess we essentially speak out against a lot of it. Now, we don't dismiss all aspects of allopathic medicine, or what's known as mainstream medicine, which people are used to seeing if they go to a GP or to a hospital, but we point out that huge elements of it are harmful. There's many, many medications that people should go nowhere near, they shouldn't touch. There are much better ways to achieve true health. And as Sam says, we became known around the world for investigating germ theory. So that's the belief, which it is, it's not a science, that microbes like bacteria and fungal cells, etc., cause disease in people. And we also have specialized in investigating the very existence of viruses. So we attack that on a number of fronts. One is, in the background, I write very technical papers, which are pretty hard reading, some of them. And then Sam does the weekly videos to make the material easy to understand to the public.
Yeah, we'll come to your book in just a moment. But before we just go down that line, have you guys, and this is the third time in my interviews this week that I've referred to this brother and sister couple from California, Casey and Kelly Means. Have you come across them? Casey Means being a Stanford-educated surgeon at the age of 30. she walked away, and she and her brother, who was a lobbyist for the food and pharmaceutical industry, he's walked away from his career as well. And together they're out to educate Americans about good living, about good food, about trying to say, for heaven's sake, stop eating toxins, which is what they believe the American food industry is all about. Have you come across them at all?
I've been sent emails about, I think they did a very prominent interview with Tucker Carlson.
And correct. Yeah, that's where I first encountered them just a week or so ago. Yeah.
Yeah, so I've heard of them. I haven't researched exactly what they've spoken about. But, I mean, of course, I think what's great is that people are coming at this from different angles to the same kind of conclusion, which is I really think it stems from people outsourcing their health and thinking, I can just take this for granted and it will sort itself out. This isn't just about health. This is about so much more, like schooling and your education, the way you think. It's a total awakening and revelation of actually how to live. And we are examples of that. We live that life because we don't want to be trapped in this system where people tell you what to eat and what to think. And I think so many of the RCR listeners will appreciate that. It's just, so definitely food is fundamental.
I think too, Peter, more doctors are speaking out about this now. The fact that it's not a health system, that's a misnomer. What we have, say, in countries like New Zealand, we don't have a Ministry of Health. We have a Ministry of Medicine, is essentially
what it is. Ministry of Sickness.
Yeah, yeah. But people have to understand that, and we came from this paradigm, doctors are not trained to administer health. They are trained to administer medicine, surgery, radiation, etc. Now, that's separate from the concept of health. So a lot of people think, well, to be healthy, you need to go and see your GP or you need to go to the hospital, this kind of stuff, when it's not true at all. There are certain things like emergencies, when people have car accidents or extremely, acute situations where they may need a hospital or a GP, etc. But the majority of time, it's not a good idea to enter that system thinking that it will make you healthy. And there's a whole lot of problems that we've covered in many of our presentations, including screening programs. So these are the very things they tell you, yep, make sure you get a regular checkup, etc., from your doctor, which is in fact a really dangerous thing to do because it leads to all sorts of problems, unnecessary investigations and interventions, and there's a huge amount of data showing that it's not a good idea. So yeah, as Sam says, it's really important that we have people who have come out of the industry who set examples and say, look, this is how we do things in our family. This is how we raise our kids. And look, we're so healthy that surely this is a good example for everyone to follow. And it's a real problem for them, Peter. How do they explain the Bailey family being so healthy when we've rejected all of the products that were on offer during the COVID era? How do they explain the fact that our kids are not engaged in the medical system and yet have perfect health? So the more of us that do this, the more people will catch on to the fact that there are better ways to live.
Yeah, well, there's an old saying, isn't there? Follow the money. And one of the extraordinary lines that came out of that Tucker Carlson interview with Kelly and Casey Means is that the biggest industry in America right now is not big tech. It is not big food. It's not car manufacturing. The biggest industry in America is healthcare. Mm. Hey? So what does that tell you? It's a combination of exorbitant fees at the doctor, exorbitant fees for surgery, for hospital care, and above everything, exorbitant fees for drugs.
And we talk about this actually in the final pandemic book, about this massive transfer of money that has occurred. And this is just from ordinary people. The money has been taken and put basically into big pharma. And we don't even know, you have no control over it because it goes via taxes and it's a roundabout where it's the same people involved in all of this money. And that's what it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, and we're not saying like all of these participants are aware of what's going on. So you certainly have the top levels of the organisation. So the organisations, the Gates Foundation, Gavi, COVAX, all of these international conglomerates, which are basically money laundering schemes, or at least schemes to rip off the public and transfer wealth to a small number of people. But a lot of the participants, they don't realise, like this includes research scientists at universities, people getting grants, etc., doctors and nurses doing tests and procedures in the system, they're all getting rewarded for participating in this process. And those that elect not to participate are getting punished. So, yeah, I mean, that was one of the chapters we wrote about in, you know, the final pandemic. It's just pointing out the obscene incentivization that they have made for people to participate. And the,
but it starts with medical education, doesn't it? Because I know that during COVID, the University of Otago proudly had the Gates Foundation and Gavi as sponsors on its website. I think when that was pointed out that maybe there was a conflict of interest with Michael Baker speaking so prominently during 2020 and 2021, signs on the website just seem to be quietly taken down. But isn't it a fact that medical schools all around the world get substantial contributions from pharmaceutical companies?
Yeah, and it's indirect, and because it's all through done through the funding kind of route. So all the kind of research and things is tends to be funded via big pharma. And when you trace it, you don't have to scratch too far beneath the surface to see what a farcical situation it is, because, yeah, the medical training, what do you learn in medical school? It's all about pharmaceuticals and how to administer them. You just become essentially a drug pusher. You don't learn about things like what Casey, the Means sibling, said about nutrition. You don't know anything about it. I mean, this is something we've learnt subsequently, and you feel foolish that, oh my gosh, I really knew nothing about it.
I remember Alison Goodwin in an interview back in my Magic Talk radio days during the early stages of the pandemic. She said to me something which you've actually put in the book as well, which I thought at the time was unbelievably profound. She said, in medical school, they don't teach you about health. They teach you about anatomy, about sickness, and about drugs. And I guess that pretty much sums things up. And every doctor that I've spoken to and put that line to actually agrees with that. But they're not really prepared to do a heck of a lot about it, it would appear, the majority of them anyway. Is that true, Mark?
Yeah, absolutely. And here we have the incentivization. So we have a group of professionals who have been in training for 6 or more years and often are in debt, you know, in six-figure debts at this point. And then they have an opportunity to start making money, and the system rewards making money in a certain fashion, and they will continue along this path. So people were astounded during the COVID era that more doctors didn't speak up, but most of them are just treated like a job. They are worried that they will lose a paycheck. They are worried that they will be perceived negatively within their profession. So most of them will not say a word. It's much easier. They can expend no effort just to say absolutely nothing, just to say stay silent and go along with it. They know from what's happened, and Sam and Peter and the others, Matt Shelton, et cetera, who they've tried to drag through this legal process over years. Other doctors look at that and go, my goodness, that's what happens for even just questioning what's going on, you know, not actually harming a patient or having any complaints from patients, et cetera, but just for going against what the government says or their agencies. So, yeah, I mean, people waiting around expecting doctors to speak up about this, it's not going to happen. And we should point out, say, in a country like New Zealand, if you go and see your doctor and they have a current medical license, there are certain things they cannot talk about, even if you directly ask them, because they know that they will potentially be investigated and struck off. Nothing to do whether the information is correct or not, but it just depends on what the Ministry of Health, what the government, what the medical council is saying at the time.
So what subjects in particular are taboo? Are you talking about the use of, for instance, ivermectin to treat a respiratory disease?
No, I'd say more like vaccines. So you don't get any doctor in New Zealand who's registered who can have an open conversation about vaccines. So, and I mean, to be honest, Peter, doctors in the system, they are clueless about vaccines, all of them. We weren't taught about them. We didn't know what was in them. We didn't really know the history of the diseases that they were supposedly protecting against. So a typical example would be if someone takes their child to a GP in New Zealand, they could ask the doctor, you say, okay, you've recommended all of these vaccines on the schedule. How much aluminium will my child be getting in total by the time that they've had all of these injections? The doctor's likely to look blankly and not really know because they haven't looked into it and they don't know that they are going to be giving the child a toxic load of aluminium. And, I mean, the establishment has all kinds of excuses for this. Us and other researchers have covered this in detail about the excuses they make up. But that would be a conversation that is, say, not permitted within the system.
What about for people my age who, when I turn 65, and that was 5 years ago, I go to the doctor for something, probably my blood pressure issues, and they say, you've turned 65, you're entitled to a free shingles vaccination. And my wife had been diagnosed with shingles. She's younger than me. She had been diagnosed with shingles and they were painful in the inside of her mouth. And I realized that this was something I didn't want to get. So I said, I'll take the shingles vaccine. I was not advised about what was in it. I was advised that it will stop you getting shingles. And after having seen what Sarah was going through, I thought that was a good idea. So I took it. And, well, I haven't had shingles since. So does things like the Shingrix vaccine work? And I noticed there was a full-page advertisement for it on the front of the Herald website yesterday. So that's just one vaccine that actually works, doesn't it?
If you want to believe it, Peter.
There's that cynical smile.
Yeah, well, this is a true story. Our eldest son, because we used to give all the vaccines as well, childhood vaccines, and I completely bought this hook, line and sinker as well, that the you can give the chickenpox vaccine, which is essentially the same, you know, idea to stop them getting chickenpox. And then it was Mark's always my canary in the coal mine. He said, have you looked into this? And we're still giving vaccines, but he said, it looks like you're more likely to get chickenpox and shingles on their own data, you know, by having these vaccines. And I was horrified because I'd actually paid for it at that point.
Yeah, but I think for us, Peter, our research always goes upstream. So we're not particularly interested in arguments downstream. So what we did is just focused on the fact that they say that these conditions shingles, they say it's the herpes zoster virus. So essentially we went back to all of the research that claimed to show the existence of this virus, and the research conclusively does not show existence of a contagious entity in the form of a virus. So nothing that stems from that, including the vaccines, makes any sense. So it's wrong, basically, based on the foundational evidence without even looking at their own statistics based on what they claim. But I mean, it's and this touches on obviously the area that we specialize in, which is the existence of viruses and contagion and the validity of germ theory, all of which have been, you know, brought to the public in the form of a giant lot of pseudoscience that has no basis. So yeah, so that's the way we tend to attack these problems. But as Sam says, this was the first time we encountered this was when we still believed in vaccines, so like a decade ago or something. And even on their own figures, it doesn't look good. So the thing to do, and Sam's Virus Mania team did this, they just went around institutions, the big ones, you know, CDC, the Robert Koch Institute, all this kind of, you know, the big names essentially out there who promote vaccines, and just ask them for one randomized control study which showed the benefits of any vaccine. And they all come back with the same response. They say, oh, do a search on PubMed, which is the database containing medical research, and you'll find plenty of studies there. And the team show them the search terms that we put in and say, look, nothing's coming back. There's various review articles, there's commentaries, there's expert opinion, but we actually want data.
Just give us one study.
Just one.
Just one.
And it's so hard. And the very few randomized control trials that the team did find were actually worse. So sometimes in the third world, they try on one of their vaccines and ends up killing children. So this is an extremely serious problem.
Yeah, I know. We've heard about those trials, haven't we? But surely you would agree that polio and smallpox, for all intents and purposes, don't exist now because we've vaccinated populations against them. Surely that debunks your argument, doesn't it, that smallpox and polio exist or existed?
The easiest thing to do for people here, and hopefully you can put a link to this, is to go to either the Dissolving Illusions charts, which are provided for free to the public.
This is a book that was written a wee while ago by Roman Bistrianic and Suzanne Humphreys that chart the actual data of mortality for all these different infectious diseases.
Or so-called infectious diseases. Yeah. And the other person, Greg Beattie in Australia, has also got the Australian data. And more recently, a guy in the US, Jordan Henderson, has put together an excellent series of colour charts. So these charts essentially trace the incidence and mortality of these diseases over time and show that by the time the vaccines were introduced, the rates of death for these conditions were down like 99% and incidence was right down too. So they'd basically become insignificant by the time the vaccines were introduced. And we've done presentations on how deceptive they are with the data. So say they introduce a vaccine like polio in the 1950s, or they include data from the 1940s through to the 1970s and just show you a little window. And then they say, wow, look at this, it's had a great impact. If you actually go back and look at the data from 1900 and over the entire century, you can see that the vaccines made no difference whatsoever.
And the other thing they do, which is very tricky, like Mark said, is the reclassification of the disease itself. And you have no idea that they've done this. So, for example, polio, they used to include all sorts of neurological conditions. So someone could have a squint, like a turned-in eye, and that would be called polio. Someone could have an injury to their knee and have like a drop foot, and that would be called polio. As soon as the vaccine comes in, then, they reclassify it to a new, you need new criteria now to be diagnosed with polio, and suddenly the numbers drop. But you're not given that, you don't understand that when you're looking at the graphs, because they don't include that all the classifications have been changed at this point. So now anytime someone comes into a doctor and it's, oh, no, you haven't got polio, you've got AMS and other types of conditions. So it's all created so that there is no polio anymore.
But do you guys agree that there has been a disease, a virus called polio? And we'll just use this as an example. I know smallpox is another one. But do you guys believe that there is a condition called the polio virus?
No.
No, there's a condition called polio, which, as Sam explained, the definition has changed markedly over time. So,
and the symptoms, the symptoms or the outcomes are often deformities in the limbs and the like. You would agree with that?
Well, as Sam said, during the era when they wanted the so-called epidemic to be around, there could be all sorts of presentations that were called polio. Initially, they'd just say you had a fever and some diarrhea, and they could say that was, you know, mild polio if there was the tiniest of neurological symptoms. And over time, they changed the classification of it into, you know, you had to have really severe symptoms. So, no, Peter, the people are getting sick for the same reasons and have done for hundreds of years, but they simply change the classifications. Now, the polio virus, which you've brought up, as a separate issue, because they're saying that the clinical picture of polio is caused by a virus. Now, there's no evidence of that whatsoever. That myth came about in the early 1900s when some Rockefeller funded projects were going on, one of the things they did was, because they were so obsessed about this developing germ theory, they started thinking that every sickness is explained by germs. And if they could see the germs, you know, like bacteria or fungi, they'd say, that must be the reason. If they couldn't see it, they'd say, well, this must be a virus. This must be something so small we can't even see it with our microscopes. So with polio, this is the initial experiment they did to, you know, allegedly prove that it was a virus. A young boy died of the clinical condition polio. They took a sample of his spinal cord and mashed it up. They formed a brew in a huge volume and then injected it into a couple of monkeys' brains. So they cut open the skulls of monkeys and injected this mixture into the brains. The monkeys then, one monkey died and one monkey got paralyzed. And then they said, hey, presto, we've just worked out the cause of polio. Now, of course, that experiment is preposterous. It does not show contagion. It does not show the existence of a virus at all. All it shows is that if you take biological muck from a diseased human and inject it straight into a monkey's brain, the monkey will get sick. Now, most of the animal experiments with all of these types of conditions are performed in similar manners. They never show contagion through a natural route. They only show that if you take biological material from a diseased animal or human and directly inject it into another animal, sometimes you can make them sick. Surprisingly, most of the time they don't even make them sick during this.
And the other thing to point out that's very important with polio is that the mass use of the poison DDT, and I've made videos on this as well, and specifically about polio. So DDT is an insecticide that was used prolifically. It's incredibly toxic. They knew this in animal studies that it affected the spinal cords in dogs, a particular part. That would be affected by DDT, and they and as soon as they basically banned DDT, the rates of polio come down as well. That the graphs are incredible that correlate perfectly with the use of DDT and the incidence of polio.
And then, of course, when DDT got banned in countries like Australia and New Zealand, the incidence of so-called polio went down, and then it went up in the third world because the DDT stockpiles were then sent to the third world. So they're still used in countries like India and Africa. So they have these neurotoxins that, you know, and lead arsenate before DDT. So a number of chemicals that eventually are found out to be incredibly toxic to humans. And once they get banned in the first world, they then start shipping them out to the third world, which is why the so-called epidemics of things like polio happened in the first world first and then in the third world second. I mean, it makes absolutely no sense at all if you're trying to explain it by a fictional virus.
Sure. So let's talk about the book. It's called The Final Plandemic. The Final
Pandemic. Yeah. I like your Freudian slip there.
I apologise for that. An Antidote to Medical Tyranny by Dr. Mark and Dr. Sam Bailey. A quote from early on in the book: the concept of contagious and death-dealing germs is finished. Now, that's it. That's the summary, I suppose. So you attracted a bit of infamy back in 2020, Mark, and I remember you talking with Rodney Hyde on this very program in 2020. In fact, I think it was before RCR even started. It was on that other online radio station before Rodney was banned from it, and I'm sure before the likes of you two were banned from the platform as well. But you talked to Rodney, Mark, and you said viruses, the COVID virus does not exist. I don't know whether at that stage you went so far as to say viruses at large don't exist, but you said the COVID virus does not exist. It is a myth. Now, I thought that was pretty out there, and of course you were roundly criticised for that. I mean, people were saying, how the hell can this guy say the COVID virus doesn't exist? Look at all these people getting sick. So what led you to the discovery, Mark, that not only does the COVID virus not exist, but the whole concept of contagious disease and contagious viruses is a myth? Germ warfare is, or the germ the germ world is a myth.
Yeah, well, I don't think Rodney didn't find out about me until about 2021, I think. And, yeah, it was on that other radio show. And it was a bit of a surprise, Peter, because obviously I think Rodney had become aware of Virus Mania, Sam's first book that she co-authored with, you know, some German authors. And the third edition of that came out in 2021. So, yeah, it was a bit later on that Rodney talked to me and he called me up and said, do you want to come on the show in a couple of hours and to talk about your research? And I said, oh, okay. I said to him, do you know that we're pretty much banned on all platforms? Like we've never been near anything mainstream for a couple of years now. I said, we're banned on Facebook. If Sam tries to upload some of her videos to YouTube, they get taken down within minutes as soon as we start talking about no virus. And Rodney said, yeah, it's no problem. Come on. And he let me talk live for an hour. And
big mistake.
Well, it was great. But anyway, then Rodney texted me the next day and said, I think I'm in a lot of trouble here. And yeah, I think he was kicked off that platform within a few days. So, but for Rodney, that was more just to him, it alerted him to the fact that there must be something more to this. And he's certainly followed our work since then. So, no, I mean, at that stage, I would have been clear that viruses don't exist at all. And so for us, that realization came about in 2020 when Sam had just launched her YouTube channel in early 2020. And it was just initially going to be about general health things and medical matters. Pretty quickly, we got inundated with questions from around the world about this brewing situation in Wuhan, and people were saying that there's some sort of virus circulating. And Sam said to me, look, I'm getting so many questions, can you start researching it? And I'd been out of medicine for 4 years at the stage and thought, okay, well, I'll give you a hand.
So why did you drop out, Mark? Why were you out of medicine even by that stage, before the whole COVID thing?
I always had a very uneasy relationship with allopathic medicine, and when I graduated, I wasn't even sure whether I wanted to continue. That was in 1999. I then had a period of 5 years where I was a professional athlete, and I absolutely loved that, but I kept my medical license and I kept a foot in the door and came back into it in 2007 when I met Sam. But I really struggled. I used to have conflict with a lot of the other practitioners. I didn't think they had any evidence for what they were doing, and they didn't. And that would lead to conflicts. I could not find a specialty to work in where I felt that I wasn't causing problems or harm for people. Many of the medicines and surgeries I would not accept for myself or my family. So I had this incredibly uneasy relationship. And in 2016, I turned 40, and I'd always made a deal with myself that I had to get out if I was still feeling this way about medicine. So in 2016, I did my last clinic, and at that stage, I said to Sam, she's younger and was earlier in her career, and I said to Sam, can you get out too? I don't think you should stay in the system. There's something evil about it. It's wrong. And Sam was definitely taking on board some of what I was saying, but at the same time, she was getting presented with a whole lot of opportunities.
Yeah, you were a TV star, weren't you, Sam?
Well, I wouldn't call it a star, but I was on a health show for a season, and then the second season, and then I got fired.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if TVNZ is still interested in what we have to say, Peter.
They're not interested in what I've got to say, so I guess that they're not too interested in what you guys are on about.
No. So obviously, yeah, it seems strange now that in 2019 Sam was featuring on TVNZ, and she was a really popular presenter. Like, the public absolutely loved her, and her patients loved her as well. So Sam was kind of staying in there when the COVID era hit. But so we've got this. Sam's got the YouTube channel. And asked me to research it. And by March 2020, I came back to Sam and I said, look, there's a major problem here. Like, I've read the WHO documents. I've been through their pivotal papers. I can't find references that show the existence of a coronavirus. I said, it all comes back to their expert opinions or other internal documents. And there's nothing really I can sink my teeth into. Around that time, a couple of papers were published. One was Fan Wu's paper out of Wuhan. That was the first paper that purportedly showed the existence of SARS-CoV-2, the so-called virus that caused COVID-19. And I said to Sam, I think there are problems here. I can't quite put my finger on it just yet. But then I discovered this book, Virus Mania, the one Sam subsequently became a co-author for. At that time, you know, it's all new to us. And so we read it and just our minds are blown because we realize we've been completely deceived in our training, that what we took for granted, the existence of viruses, had not been established, that this was a model that came about in the late 1800s. They constantly sought over, you know, the century to prove the existence of viruses, but none of their experiments could do it or were sufficient to do it. So by April 2020, we were in a position where we thought, oh my goodness, this whole thing is a fraud. There's no basis to it. Now, there were other aspects that woke us up to the fraud, and one was the definition of COVID-19, which was essentially a circular definition. They said it didn't matter what symptoms or signs you had. It all came back to a molecular detection test. So initially that was PCR. Later on, that was the rapid antigen test. And we thought, why are no doctors saying anything? How can you have a test which defines the condition and the condition which defines the test? This is just going round and round. And sure enough, by June 2020, the Cochrane Collaboration, which within the industry is very well respected, they published a systematic review and said that there are no specific signs or symptoms of COVID-19. There's no way a clinician can rule it in or rule it out. It all comes back to the PCR. And we thought, oh my goodness, it's a complete scam. The whole thing is just based on a test. And where you take the test, you find the cases. The cases are not new, like in terms of it's not a specific new type of illness. I know some doctors claim that, but if you look at the official definition, it's not at all. So yeah, it was a number of things that happened. And by late 2020, we'd started investigating many of these so-called viruses and finding out they just didn't have proof for any of them. And the whole model was fraudulent. Now, I mean, by the time I spoke to Rodney, the research we'd done was incredibly well developed. So I know it's shocking for the public to hear this stuff for the first time. But, you know, when I've written like a 29,000 word essay specifically addressing this problem, I haven't left any stones unturned here. I've looked everywhere. And we don't just look at things like the papers which claim to show these viruses with their electron microscopy, with their cell cultures, etc. I mean, we look at antibody tests. We look at epidemiology. We look at how diseases are classified over time, you know, what we've talked about, how they change the definitions, etc. We've looked at all of the contagion studies. We've looked at all of the animal experiments, etc. We haven't left one aspect of this that we haven't looked into: genomics, PCR, all of the technical aspects. My goodness, Peter, I've spent years immersed in the bowels of the virology literature, and it's so boring.
Yeah, but the point is, guys, people still get sick. People still get the flu, you know, in quotation marks. People still get crook. They're either vomiting or they're coughing and sneezing and, you know, having trouble breathing. So there are bugs, particularly in places like kindergartens and preschool centres and the like. There must be something causing it. And people say, oh, it's airborne disease. You catch it off this person, you catch it off that person. Yet you guys say that there's no such thing as a contagious illness. How come?
Well, I think as we say, what we do is we deal with pivotal science. We don't deal with anecdotal stories. So, I mean, we get that all the time in talks that we give. Someone will stand up and say, yes, but when I was a child, two of us got chickenpox and then a third person got it, da, da, da. That's an anecdotal story. That's not scientific evidence. So what we looked at was the studies which claim to show human-to-human transmission of disease. Now, there's over 200 of these studies. And
it's a great book about it, yeah.
Yeah, our friend Daniel Reuters, an Australian researcher, he's actually just published a book called Can You Catch a Cold, which I think people should read if they have any doubts about whether this thing called contagion with germs is real. and just going through all the experiments they tried to transmit disease between people. Now, this includes some of the research we've uncovered is really interesting because it includes the so-called sexually transmitted infections where they actually did do human experiments in the days before they had ethics committees. So back in the 1940s and 50s, they'd do all kinds of experiments with people. And also going back to the Spanish flu, that's one that people really need to understand, was that the Spanish flu was said to be one of the most contagious and deadly conditions. It was thought to be airborne. It was thought to be transmitting around with the greatest of ease. Well, they actually did do a series of human experiments, and they tried everything to infect, healthy people from diseased people. And they had no success whatsoever. So this included taking material like sputum and snot directly from sick people and injecting it into well people. It didn't do anything. It didn't make them unwell. So people do get sick, but this mechanism of contagious germs is not the reason they get sick.
So why do we get sick then? Why do we have minus sniffles and snuffles and occasionally tummy upsets?
Yeah, so it's how our body heals. it's actually the part of the healing that happens when we've been, and there's a whole host of reasons. So viruses are like a cover story for all sorts of reasons why people get sick. So it can be things like stress, not enough sleep, the wrong kind of diet, nutritional deficiencies. It's like it's endless of all the different reasons why people actually present with illnesses. And we're not denying that people don't get sick. I think sometimes we're accused of saying, oh, you're an AIDS denialist or whatever. No, no, these conditions are real. People do get sick. But the reasons for them are not what we've been told. And I love the analogy that someone, not me, came up with about, well, it's like saying, you know, why do we have presents under the tree? You know, what's the reason? It's, well, everybody knows, you know, why that happens, but there's evidence. How does it go?
Presents under the Christmas tree is not evidence of Santa Claus, is it? There are other reasons
why things happen. Yeah.
And you have to be a little bit more sophisticated than the childlike conception that there's only one thing that could possibly explain it. Mm. I think what helps, Peter, and what we did in the book in the final pandemic was go through historical examples where doctors were so convinced that germs were causing the problem that they actually caused carnage and caused great harm in the population until they found out what was the cause of things like beriberi and pellagra. Another example that's really...
What are they?
So these are nutritional deficiencies, which initially were thought to be caused by germs. So, and if you look back, and we've covered the details in the book about how insane it was, the doctors were just trying to work out which germ was causing the problem. And they spent years focused on it, and they were reporting, this is what's really disturbing, is that some of them were giving things to kill microbes and claiming that it was successful. Now, we know that can't possibly be true because they were nutritional deficiencies. And one of the easiest ones for people to understand is scurvy. So scurvy is caused by a lack of vitamin C in the diet. And once upon a time, ships would head out to sea for weeks or months at a time. And sometimes 6 weeks into the journey, a sailor would come down with scurvy. Gums would start bleeding, start getting unwell, etc. And then the next day, two more would come down and the captain would think, uh-oh, we've got an outbreak on the ship. And they would start quarantining them. But it didn't work. And they'd think, oh my goodness, this is so incredibly infectious that eventually the entire ship comes down with it. So of course, many of them, it took years for them to work out that the problem was vitamin C. And
only to start putting fresh fruit and vegetables on the old sailing ships, the crew stayed healthy.
Exactly. But
Captain Cook was one of the first, Captain Cook ships were amongst the first to discover that, weren't they? They were first to use that method.
Yeah, and they worked out that you had to stop in at some of the Pacific Islands and get fruit, basically, to get some vitamin C. And over time, they worked out ways to make preserve food, etc., so that the sailors wouldn't get sick. But that's an example of where at the time people were so convinced that there was an infectious germ passing around that they you know, caused these huge mistakes and made the population even sicker. So we have the same thing going on now, is that people don't understand why they're getting sick, and instead they go to the medical system and take things like antibiotics, or they think they're taking vaccines as preventatives, etc., when none of this can possibly help. So the body doesn't have specific diseases as the allopathic system dictates. I mean, that's just made up essentially in order to bring about protocols with pharmaceuticals and essentially to suit the industry's own purposes. The body just has conditions.
How do you account for, say, a preschool centre where there's a whole lot of 3 and 4 year olds, all with snuffles and coughs, and the teachers saying to the parents, "Your kid's got a runny nose, I don't want him or her in tomorrow because he or she is going to infect the rest of the class." And before you know it, out of 25 kids, half of them are away because they've got the sniffles and the snuffles and they're told not to infect others. I mean, how do you account for the fact that, A, half the kids have got it and or got this illness, got this disease, and B, isn't it a natural reaction on the part of the teacher to say, keep your kid away to stop infecting the others?
Is it a normal situation to have like 25 or 30 kids of the age of 3 and about, you know, 3 to 5 or younger in this concentrated situation? Like, is this a normal kind of setup where...
Well, in modern-day New Zealand it is, because...
I know that.
Both work, the kids go off to preschool.
Exactly. Would you say that it's a stressful situation for kids to be in?
Yes, because mum and dad aren't around and their home comfortable environment is missing and they're in a place with kids they don't know so well.
Exactly. And like they're like little human, you know, little adults. We would be the same if we were in the same kind of setting. I think we almost exclude, like, what is going on in the situation? Why would they be getting sick? Not just like there's a bug that's passing around. I think personally that preschools and that and I know why parents do it. We used to do it when our children were little and we're both working. It's a highly stressful, abnormal situation to have all these young children together, and it's all the other things that go along with it. With children in particular, there's only so many ways that they can detox, and one of the classic ways is via rashes and via the skin, and also with coughing and runny nose. You're trying to detox. You're trying to get rid of. And when children are stressed, just like adults, we have a buildup of things like cortisol in our blood. These are actual scientific reactions to stress. So we have a mental thing that causes a physical problem. And so it's real.
Yeah, the other thing, Peter, is that those children in those circumstances have a common environmental factor. So there may be something that they all ingested and got sick. So it's similar to when you go to a restaurant and you're at a table of 10 and 5 people order the chicken that evening, and all 5 of them the next day, you know, report back and say, oh my goodness, I was up all night, diarrhea, vomiting, etc. Now, we don't say in that circumstance that there's something infectious passing around. They've all just had a bout of food poisoning, etc. It's not people making other people sick. It's a common environmental factor. So in that case, they've all ingested, you know, chicken that was not fit for human consumption, which is different than germs causing sickness. So
a Campylobacter, for instance, is not the same as a virus.
Well, that's different. So Campylobacter is a bacterial species, but Campylobacter, there's no experiment in the world that shows that Campylobacter by itself will make a healthy animal sick. So Campylobacter is a reaction. So you will see it. Say waterways get contaminated with things that are not fit for human consumption. So this could mean fecal material or other toxins. That's what will make you sick, not the bacteria by themselves. So this has actually been known about for a very long time. So since the late 1800s and early 1900s, there were doctors like von Pettenkofer, Fraser, Powell, a whole lot of them had already shown that this theory about germs making you sick was incorrect. So they used to swallow things like the bacteria that was supposed to cause cholera. diphtheria, all of the, at the time, you know, very dangerous conditions that killed a lot of people. So they would take the bacterial broths and they would swallow them or inhale them, and do this with dozens of volunteers, and not one of the healthy people would get sick. So that is not the mechanism as to how people get sick. The science is incredibly clear on that. And unfortunately, we've got all this mythology, which is pervasive in our community, where people think, oh, there must be something passing around. And the daycare center is the classic, or the schoolroom, etc. But we would just say, as Sam said, and I know parents find this hard to hear, but daycare centres are not a good idea at all. The trauma that you put your kids through when at that age, going off by themselves and being in a room with complete strangers is really damaging. And look, we made the mistake with our oldest kids in their teens now, and we did put them in daycare, you know, more than a decade ago, and we realise now it was a huge mistake. Mm-hmm. Our youngest children have never, ever been in any of those facilities and have the most incredible health that you could imagine, to the point where they basically never get sick. So I think it's one of those, it's a tough decision that people have to make about, if you want your family to be well, there are certain ways that you have to live. And they're not necessarily conducive with what the modern world wants, which is for mum and dad to be at work all day, for the kids to be fobbed off to so-called educational institutes. And our family and many others are examples of why you don't do that if you want to have true health.
But having said that, and I know that you guys homeschool your children, even it would appear into high school level, a lot of parents are not prepared to do that. So the normal thing, I'll say normal again with quotation marks, the normal thing to do with your children is, even if they don't go to a preschool or a kindergarten, at the age of five, they go off to usually a state school, and they then do 12 years of education through primary and secondary school. Now, that's good, surely, on a number of fronts, not the least of which is socialization, which is important. They'll also get an education of, yes, I will admit, varying quality, depending on which institution they're at, whether it's private or public. But the point is that it's generally accepted, it's a good place for kids to go to grow up. Now, you've made the opposite decision, but at those places they go, are they likely to get sick because of bugs going around or because of the stress that they're under? I mean, the point is, when you go to school, you get sick, and lots of kids in a class are often sick at the same time. So how do you explain that? Well, a lot of stuff there to unpack, but, you know, you guys are going down a different route with the way that you're raising your children. And all power to you. That's your choice as parents. You have the right to do that. But what you're doing is not the normal thing. I guess you're in a position where you can perhaps afford to do that. And you've made the decision to do that. Not a lot of parents will.
Well, I think, Peter, our kids used to go to private schools, which are incredibly expensive, in fact. So for us, it's actually cheaper now in terms of not paying school fees. But yeah, I mean, this gets to the wider problem of the so-called education system. And I think it's incredibly dangerous to send your kids into that right now, because it's not only, you know, the social pressures that they're under there because of the way a lot of kids are behaving now, but the indoctrination they get is so bad that they're not taught to think properly for themselves. And, you know, we see the incredible psychological harms that are being done in these educational institutes now, so which manifests in health. So in terms of, yeah, when you want, I mean, we deal with health is what we deal with. And when we're dealing with that, you cannot take any shortcuts. And if you think that you can, as Sam says, outsource things to other people, you have to be extremely careful. Now, if you need some plumbing done in your house, it's probably a good idea to outsource that, because the plumber has got tools and skills that you potentially don't have. But I would be very careful with regard to what you think you're getting if you send your kids off to these institutions, because I don't think that they will end up with optimal health and well-being. So, yeah, and I think we hear this all the time, that people don't have time for homeschooling or can't afford it, etc. We had no experience in this field in educating kids until we just took it on board, and the benefits from it are so astounding. And people have to decide what is it that their priority is. Is it to make money and, you know, climb the corporate ladder or get career advancement, etc., or is it to look after their family? And for us, it's clear that we look after our family. So, yeah, but and what else were we unpacking there about whether your kids?
What about your kids and their lack of contact with other kids of their own age? I mean, do your kids, they're obviously not in a class on a daily basis, so therefore they're not mixing with 25 or 30 other children of a similar cohort. How do they take part in social activities? For instance, your teenager, how does your teenager get on with other teenagers, or how does he or she even know other teenagers in your neighbourhood?
Yeah, I don't know about you, Peter, but I don't want to be stuck in a room with 30 people my age. I've never found that to be an advantage. I personally love it when I'm mixing with people from the older generation and from the younger, and the conversations are absolutely fascinating. But no, I mean, the kids are still, the community, particularly where we live, is very strong. So we have our Christian networks, and Christian families tend to be big. 3-4 kids is the norm. So our kids have quite a network there. They are still engaged in all their sports activities. So they go to about 3 practices a week in which they're mixing with kids similar age, sometimes a bit older as well. So that's not an issue at all. And that's one of the fallacies that's been put forward by particularly the education establishment, you know, that there's all these problems with socialisation, etc. I guarantee if most people speak to homeschool children, they would be astounded at how worldly and mature they are. And also, too, to give you an example, when our boys do mix with other kids now, they come home horrified about the language that's being used, about the obscenities and perverse kind of things that these other kids are talking about. And our kids know that this is unhealthy stuff. And yet this is what goes on in the schools. It's lowest common denominator. I mean, and I'm sure you're aware of this. It's not something we specialize in because our research is focused elsewhere. But I mean, the harms they're doing to kids with this gender identity and stuff is massive.
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
When you homeschool your kids, they don't get exposed to any of this nonsense. So they're very resistant to it. And I mean, it's amusing for us because occasionally in the car, I turn on the mainstream radio, and if I've got, say, my 11-year-old there sitting next to me, and he's just going, "Oh, Dad, listen to the propaganda." And he's like, "Did they say what?"
And, you're a very smart 11-year-old who knows, A, the word propaganda, and B, what it means. Excellent.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Or if there's some Ministry of Health announcement, he just goes, "Dad, why do these doctors believe such silly stuff?" So, I mean, this is the big advantage, is that you equip your kids. And look, Peter, we were contacted by more and more people who are doing homeschooling and are just amazed at the benefits. It is a mindset. Like, 10 years ago, I was, like most people, thinking, I need my time away from the kids, etc., and I can't be around them 24 hours a day. It was a complete mindset change. So now, as a family, we sit down and have lunch and dinner together every day. So 7 days a week, we sit down as a family for both lunch and dinner. And
you have such strong relationships with them too. Like, you know your kids, and I think that, to me as well, was the biggest fear I had about homeschooling. Was one, I thought, am I capable to do this? Can I actually teach them? Like, do I know it? I don't feel like I know enough. And I know I've done medical training, but it's like a very specific area. It's not on all these different things, like how to write and all this kind of stuff. And then I thought, I can teach myself, I can do this. And part of it is you're learning together. And the fear I had was, yeah, having them around all the time. I thought, this is going to drive me mad. But actually, it really, I felt like the relationships improve so much more. You know them. And I now see what's going on. I mean, the transgender stuff is just, I mean, as everybody knows, it's insane. And we, it's only been really in the last 5 or 10 years, we've had lots of friends where their kids are transitioning. This, you know, this was never, you never saw this. Why has this all come about? It's because of the schooling.
Of the indoctrination and the propaganda, as your 11-year-old says. So do you guys get a curriculum from, I don't know, it used to be called the Correspondence School. It's probably got another name now. But do you get a set course of work for your kids from a government agency, or do you get it from another source, i.e. a private education provider?
Yeah, there's lots of different ways to homeschool, and I've tried different set curriculums and things, and I've just found that particularly for our family, this one works. It's sort of a mishmash of different things. So I get like the maths level was kind of what they should be at their age, and which is like a book that they go through. We do reading. You know, we study the Bible, we go through economics, Austrian economics, and we do things that I, like, I'm interested in and that the boys are interested in as well, so whatever that is. And I feel like, because I reflect back, I went to private schools, I went through the whole, all the way, you know, to the top, as it were. I learned, and I reflect back and I think, what did I learn? It was just indoctrination of dogma. And I feel like the last 4 years, 5 years in particular, I've had to unlearn so many things. And that's what we do now, is go, okay, it's not that. So what's really going on here? And that's what I feel with the boys is, I'm not saying I'm perfect. I'm learning with them. But it's, what's cool is that you do it together, and it feels like this is far more authentic. Like if we want to learn how to, I don't know, fix a bike, Mark can show them, this is what we're going to do today, and we're going to do some bike mechanics. Yeah. And, you know, there's just so many different things you can focus on, and actually practical applications. They're out helping us, you know, working, physically doing things on the on our small plot. And I feel this feels authentic and right. And, you know, I don't want a university education for them. If they want to do
it. What happens when they get to the age where they finish high school at 17, 18, finish what would have been their tertiary education in an establishment? A, do they get any NCEA or International Baccalaureate qualification or UE qualification? Do you want them to go on to a higher education? I mean, what do you see for their future beyond the homeschooling that you've given them?
Yeah, well, they can if they want to. So you can actually, there's lots of homeschooling programs where you can hook back in if you want those qualifications. I don't personally see it. We know people that are doing varsity right now. I don't know if you know anything about it, but it's pretty crazy what's going on.
My children have all graduated. They're all proud graduates of the University of Canterbury. Like you, Mark, you were a UC guy originally, weren't you, before you went to Dunedin? Sam, you were an Otago student in your time. Those two places now, particularly Otago, Sam, I wouldn't have a child or a grandchild go within 50 kilometres of the place, frankly.
Exactly. And this is the thing. It's like, what do you want? And I don't have all the answers. I'm not sure, but I feel like if it is starting their own business, if it is learning, you know, skills, real skills, I think that's great. But I'm also, they have to make their own way in the world and figure out what is the best path. And I mean, I'm not being hindered by thinking I have to be in the schooling system in order for them to get their qualifications and for them to go down this route. Most of the people we interact with that are fully awake and get what's going on in the world, they don't have very fancy qualifications and things. They've started their own businesses. They're very confident and self-assured and making their own way in the world. And that's what I want for our kids, is to, you know, whatever that
would be. Are they interested in health, in the health, I won't say industry, but the health profession, Mark? Do they have an interest in wellness and maybe in educating other people like you guys are in keeping people well?
Oh, definitely. And I mean, I've been their role model. I still train every day, you know, and keep extremely fit. So the boys, that's the other great thing about homeschooling is halfway through the day, I say to the boys, let's go. And we might go out for a 10-kilometer run up the river or something. And it's really great to see them embracing that. And unlike most kids, they can just run for miles and they don't complain of being hungry or needing food or anything like that. So, yeah, they're sort of embracing the health principles as well. But we've told them that medicine, the way it's arranged right now with licenses, et cetera, is not the way to go. So I don't think they would let them into medical school anyway.
They've got our name.
Yeah, that's right. They're Bailey kids. Bailey kids.
And also, Peter, if you actually talk to them, despite, you know, the oldest is in early teens and the others are younger, but they're all, if anyone even interviewed them for university, I think they would quickly say, you can't come in here, because they just shoot straight and they just, when it comes to things like, you know, what is a male and a female, they'll tell you, like the biological definitions, they'll tell you about the chromosomes, etc. But so, no, at this stage, look, we've just said to them we're going to support whatever they want to do. And I think it's really great living in the country because they can actually see, unlike, you know, Wellington, where you've got all these bureaucrats and accountants and auditors and stuff who basically do nothing apart from shift documents around. Out in the country, it's the real deal. I mean, there's people operating heavy equipment, there's trenching going on, there's hedging going on.
There's droughts and weather.
Hey, yeah, you're not telling me anything, right? I live in the middle of Central Otago, so I know exactly what you're saying. I'm halfway between the vast metropolises of Terrace and Cromwell. So, you know, there's not a lot of people around where I live either. So there's something special about living in the country. Your kids are lucky. I'm lucky. You're lucky. But we know that not everybody is in a position to be able to do that. So you do speak from a position of some privilege. So then what would your advice be for people who might feel bound to an income stream at the very least in a big city? What do you say to them to improve their general well-being to get out into the wide open spaces?
Yeah, well, I guess I was using the example there, of course, that most people don't live in the country like we do, but using the example of our boys being able to witness real work going on. So, you know, people that buy a truck or a digger, for instance, make the capital investment and then look for a return on it, but only if they can bring benefits to the community that people, you know, are willing to pay for their services, etc. So, yeah, I would just encourage anyone to look for something real. Like, and unfortunately, governments have created these entire industries where we have lawyers, accountants, auditors, etc., who are all doing work. These are just make work schemes from the government, etc., that have nothing to do with bringing goods and services that the public actually want. So my advice to people is always find something that has true value that other people are prepared to pay for your goods and services, etc. And it is tough because the playing field is arranged against it, and some of the highest paid people do work within the government or the para-government industries. So, but I think the more of us that focus on grassroots stuff, doing something real, the better. And so that's where we put our focus because Peter, we were raised, you know, in an environment where we were told, get your ticket, you know, which was a medical license or a dental license or something like that. And this was a very common thing that was told to us as kids.
Sure. Learn a trade, learn a profession so that you've got
very much
something for life.
Yeah,
very much a profession. And trades are different because the trades are actually doing something usually extremely useful, like building houses or, you know, creating infrastructure, etc. But a lot of the professions, including medicine, are these literally getting tickets to make a lot of money without necessarily being useful to the community. And I mean, that's the problem of having government involved and dictating these sectors. I mean, the government should just get out of the way. Of course, we come from a position as Christian anarchists. So, we were anarchists before we were Christians, well before. So, many decades ago, we gave up on all political involvement. We don't vote. We don't participate in any of their rituals. We pretty much ignore what governments do.
That's why the medical council was scared of me.
But I've just had another thought. You're talking about living in the country, and we hear stories almost on a weekly basis of people not being able to get a registration at a GP. They can't enrol at their general practice at their local medical centre because the medical centre is too full and there's the shortage of GPs. You know, I came to live in the country, 2.5-3 years ago, and I have enrolled at a medical centre in Cromwell. I had absolutely no problems whatsoever. One or two times I've been there, never had an issue getting an appointment pretty quickly, and every time I go, the waiting room is never full. There's only one or two people in there, and you've got to practice with four or five doctors. And just hearing you speak before suggests that maybe life in the country is healthier and people don't need to go to the doctor so often. It's just a random thought that maybe the country GP is not all that stressed. I don't know. What's your experience of that?
Well, I think from just previous experience, I think as a country GPs, they have to deal with lots of accidents and real kind of more trauma and things like that. So they're very important, I think, in that regard. But yeah, and farming people tend to be tough. They don't go in unless it's like, you know, a leg's falling off or something. So they tend to not really go in very much. But I think, I really feel like this is a mindset shift, maybe that you need, Peter, as well. As you don't need a doctor to be well or for health. It's like this idea that you should be your own doctor, and this is what we try and do, is teach people how to be well, so you don't even need this crutch, because it kind of, for some, it's a real addiction. It's like going in and, oh, I've always got it there. It's just, then I'll just check with my doctor. You don't need them.
No, and yeah, if the Ministry of Health and the Medical Council, etc., are listening to our broadcast today, we know that they advise people to register at medical centres, but the doctors, Bailey, would advise that you do the opposite, that you deregister, because you don't need, you know, to have this regular service, basically, which is, as we talked about, it's a medical system. It is not a health system. I mean, the emergency services, they'll always be there. There's no doubt about that. So if you have a car accident or fall out of a tree, et cetera, the New Zealand acute services are absolutely brilliant. Our ambulance and paramedics, our emergency staff, et cetera. But that's a tiny proportion of the medical system. The vast majority of the medical system is unnecessary. And for people who are worried about waiting times at GPs, et cetera, you have to say, well, what do you want to see them for? Because they're not health centres, they're medical centres. And a lot of what we concentrate on is showing people why they don't need to be a part of that allopathic system. They can completely walk away from it. As our family have done, and as many families have done. And people get worried because they think, well, what if there is an emergency? And that's not a worry. You don't have to be registered at a practice. An ambulance will still come and pick you up. The staff won't care what your thoughts are about registering at a medical practice. That's not a worry at all. So we just encourage people, try and change your mindset. This cradle to grave nonsense that they've tried to create, that you need to outsource your health and that you need to participate in their system, is complete nonsense. And I mean, as you pointed out earlier on, Peter, the so-called health industry has become a monster. It is just consuming vast amounts of the public's resources and money, and the outcomes are not good at all.
And no, if you never go, Peter, you know that they get capitation funds every 3 months. So, and these can be massive just from being on their list. They get a lot of money
just for you being on their books. Here's a quote from your book, The Final Pandemic, page 181, towards the end. Real health is achieved through right thinking and right living. Life is for living, not living in fear. That's pretty profound. And is that, that's a real summary of your attitude towards life, isn't it? Life is for living, not living in fear. And it seems, particularly since March of 2020, as if the health industry in this country, the medical industry in this country, has wanted us to live in fear. They did well for a while. They're still trying. What's this thing called monkeypox or various other things that, you know, there's going to be another pandemic. I mean, they keep on chipping away, don't they? They weren't satisfied with what they achieved the first time around. They want to do it again, don't they?
Yeah, and this is what our books have been about. So, you know, Sam's first book, Virus Mania, her authors warned about this in 2007. They said that these pandemics are going to eventually encompass the world. There's no biological or scientific reality going on. It's just a pure marketing campaign. It's for a number of purposes. One is to bring populations under control through the fear mechanism. And another is to channel them into various behaviors, whether that's participating in rituals like lockdowns and vaccinations and masks, et cetera, as well as transferring vast amounts of wealth. It's an absolute fraud going on. So the reason we called this book The Final Pandemic was to announce to people that it's purely their choice whether they want to have more pandemics or not. They're not real biological entities. There's no it going around. There's no such thing as contagious viruses and germs that are coming to get you. This is all complete nonsense. We've been through the foundational science over and over again to show why that can't possibly be the reason people get sick, etc. So we just hand it over to the public and say, here's the information. It's up to you guys to make the choice. And we found that ignoring everything they were saying in 2020 brought our family to incredible health and well-being. While we witnessed those going along with it, getting sick, suffering, getting into a fear-based mindset of helplessness, giving up their rights, you know, foolishly, and allowing governments and corporations to walk all over them. So we know that governments will only try it on if they think they have enough support. So in 2020, the reason people went along with lockdowns, we believe it all came down to fear, that they actually believed that something was coming that might affect them, that they might be dead or they might get sick and pass it on to grandma. They actually believed that story. That was the selling point. As soon as people can see that that's false, that that's not what's going on, they don't go along with any of it. And it only takes a relatively small proportion of the public not to go along with something and they give up. Like, for instance, there's apparent legislation in New Zealand that outlaws all kinds of things, but because everybody ignores it, the government take no action. They don't enforce it. So we're at this crossroads with this, you know, what we call and others have called the pandemic industry. It's a complete fraud. And if people want to participate in it, they will get what comes and it's not going to be good. And one of the things we've talked about in the background is the biosecurity surveillance state. And if you look at some of the nasty, nasty stuff that governments can do or think they can do against individuals and businesses, etc., under the guise of biosecurity, this is totally draconian stuff where they can take your resources off you, where they can restrict you from moving, etc. Now, as I say, if people believe that there is contagion, that there is deadly pandemics, etc., they may think, well, that's justified doing these things. And that's the grave mistake. So that's what we try and point out to people.
All right. Well, it seems like a good point to wind things up here today. We have spoken for, an hour and a half, and it has been absolutely fascinating covering a wide range of issues and talking about your most fascinating life and your absolute pushback against the establishment. Before we go, though, a couple of things. You said, Sam, in earlier correspondence that you had a deal for RCR listeners for the book, The Final Pandemic, An Antidote to Medical Tyranny. And you should also tell us about your ongoing website as well and the information you're posting on that.
Yeah, so this is the first time we've done this, Peter. We're very excited to offer it, actually. So it's, there's a 15% discount. We tried to get 20%, but they wouldn't let us. So it's 15% off the book, of The Final Pandemic, which is our latest book. And if you go to Lulu Books or lulu.com, we'll attach, I guess, a link where people can go.
It's L-U-L-U.
Yeah, Lulu. And Lulu Books have been great. They're like Amazon is, you know, the main place where people buy books. But Lulu helps us a lot because they're independent and they we can basically self-publish through them. So it helps us the most if people use Lulu, buy from Lulu Books. So anyway, you can get your own copy if you put in RCR in the code with the link.
Yeah, so that promo code will give 15% off. A lot of people still buy a book off Amazon because the shipping to New Zealand can be cheaper. But as Sam said, Lulu really helps us. If people want to support Lulu, that would be great. And the RCR promo code, I think, is active for the next couple of weeks. So if people want to use that. And then, and Sam's website, as you mentioned. So pretty much everything is there. So
the website, sorry, is Dr. Sam Bailey, BAILEY.com. And it's all about me. Mark's got a wee page on there, but it's mostly about me.
Is that DRSAM? DRSAMBailey.com,
yep.
Right?
That's it.
Yeah. So there, Peter, there's so many resources. There's Sam's videos, which are often about 15 to 20 minutes, and they make the information readily digestible for the public. But for those wanting to take a deep dive and see exactly what we're talking about, there are all our technical papers published on the website as well. So my A Farewell to Virology, the 2022 publication, is there, as well as shorter essays which are published, which deal very much with the technical issues of what we're talking about. So there are so many resources at the website, and pretty much all of them are free to the public. So
very good.
Yeah.
A bit of light reading. I'll recommend it to Judith Simeon from the Medical Council. Eh?
Or is it Joan? Joan Simeon.
Oh, Joan Simeon, rather, yeah.
Yeah. She might come after you soon.
Hey, guys, thank you so much. Thank you so much from the bottom of my heart for your time today. Like I say, it's been a long conversation, but it's been a fun one. You present a different outlook on life. I wish you all the best. You obviously lead a very happy, contented, and fulfilled life. And wouldn't it be great if we could all do the same thing? Thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Peter.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.